Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bob Dittmer. I'm the spokesperson for the Department of Labor. I just want to make a few introductory remarks before we start our press briefing this morning. First thing I'd ask you to do is to take out your phasers and set them on stun, please. Okay, over the past 6 months, obviously there's been a lot of interest in the public and among you, the media, about the IOSHA investigation into the State Fair accident in August of 2011. Throughout this time, the Department of Labor has concentrated very hard on conducting a thorough investigation of what occurred and to providing a public presentation of our findings and results. And this presentation today is that presentation of our finding and results from 6 months of investigation. As a reminder, this is a news conference specifically for the news media. If you're attending for some other reason, you are indeed welcome. But please understand that we are only going to be taking questions from qualified news media representatives during our session today. The briefing is set to last approximately 1 hour. We're perfectly willing to go over that to make sure that we get all of your questions in, so we're not tied to that 1 hour period. We're going to start with an initial briefing on the outcome of the IOSHA investigation by Department of Labor Commissioner Lori Torres. That will be followed by your questions. We're going to reserve about 10 or 15 minutes at the end of the question and answer period. We have some media representatives who have dialed in on our telephone system from around the state to be able to listen in and participate, but we'll take their questions at the end. We'll take your questions first. Should you wish a copy of the complete investigation materials, the investigation files themselves, they are going to be able to be made available to you today on a DVD simply by going to the Department of Labor office upstairs in the Government Center South and signing an APRA request, and we'll give you a DVD with all of the files that are publicly releasable. Once we get to our question and answer period this morning, Commissioner Torres will recognize you for the questions, and I would ask please that you identify yourself by name and your news outlet as a preface to your question. So that everybody has a chance to ask their questions, I would ask that you hold follow-up questions till later. Let's make sure everybody gets their questions in. And then at the end, we should have plenty of time for follow-up and additional questions. And on that note, let me begin by introducing to you the Commissioner of the Department of Labor, Lori Torres.
Thank you all for joining us here this morning. Most of you know that it is not routine for us to hold a press conference to release a set of safety orders, but we also recognize that this event is different. So many of us were there, we watched it on TV, we looked at it in your print publications, we saw it on YouTube and other media outlets, or we contributed to the Remembrance Fund, that we really do feel a part of this. And we do believe that there is a public stake in this. So we felt that we owed it to the public. We felt that we owed it to you as the gatekeepers of information for the public to do more than just post this on our website like we do most of our safety orders. At 11 a.m., they will be posted to our website, you here in the room. We've given you a written copy of it already. But this is an opportunity for us to provide some context to the safety orders and to answer some questions about our investigation. Despite the heroism that we witnessed by many Hoosiers, August 13, 2011 was a tragic day. We extend our condolences to all the many families and individuals that were touched by this, not just the two employee deaths that we investigated. My hope is that today represents at least a partial step towards closure for all of those that were affected. I want to establish clearly the parameters of our investigation because it is as important to state what this is not as it is to state what it is. The Indiana Department of Labor, through its Indiana Occupational Safety and Health Administration, undertook a six-month investigation of whether any health or safety standards that were owed to employees on the premises were violated. It does not address duties to the public. It was not an investigation of causation. IOSHA does not, as standard practice, establish causation. When an employee is killed while working in Indiana, Our law establishes a duty on the employer to report that to IOSHA or to ensure that it is reported to us. And IOSHA then determines whether it falls within its jurisdiction to investigate that fatality. In the case of the roof structure collapse at the state fair, two employees were killed and a number of others were injured. Glenn Goodrich, who was employed by ESG Security, was working as a security guard near the stage and was killed when the roof collapsed. He was working approximately in this corner here. Nathan Bird was employed as a truss spot operator, and he was seated in a truss chair, which is a small seat located up in the roof of the structure, operating a truss spot, or what we might commonly call a spotlight, when the roof collapsed. He was also killed. We determined that he was an employee of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees Local 30 at the time of his death. This particular picture, you can actually see him here in this truss chair right here. Other employees were present, including three other truss spot operators. Want to do the phone, please? And other stagehands, security guards of ESG, state fair employees, Indiana State Police employees, Mid-America Sound Corporation employees, Epic Lighting employees, and employees of Lucky Star, which is the corporate name of the band Sugarland. Some of the others were injured, but it is specifically the deaths of the security guard and the truss spot operator that invoked our jurisdiction and our duty to investigate. This investigation has taken nearly 6 full months due to its complexity, the number of parties and entities on site, and due to the tremendous difficulty to obtain information and often cooperation from the many parties. I attribute this in part to the enormity of the exposure of risk to the public and private entities, but this deed did indeed prolong our investigation and complicate the investigation. Our average time for a safety inspection is about 60 days. Where a fatality is involved, the average is about 90 days. This case took 175 days of nearly full-time work for two compliance officers. It involved well over 2,000 man hours. It required a search warrant, court intervention, and scheduling nearly every meeting, every document exchange, and interview through attorneys. I'm going to outline the findings with respect to the various parties, and then I will circle back around and give more detail about each safety order, and then we'll take your questions, and we will endeavor to get all of them time permitting. I want to emphasize again that IOSHA's duty and investigation was not to determine the causation of the collapse of the roof structure. That investigation is a subject of Thornton Tomasetti's work. IOSHA's investigation is to determine if established safety standards were violated by any employer with employees on site. At the conclusion of our 6-month investigation, we have issued 3 safety orders to different entities: the Indiana State Fair Commission, Mid, who owned and erected the temporary Local Number 30 of the International Alliance of Employees, including theatrical payroll, constructed the roof structure. I'll probably refer to this last entity as the Union or IMC Local 30. No other entities other than these 3 were cited. As to the Indiana State Commission, as the venue, we found that it failed to meet certain standards found in the National Fire Protection Association Life Safety Code, including an appropriate assessment of conditions and safety measures and exposure to severe weather and hazards associated with temporary structural systems. This finding is classified as serious, resulting in a penalty totaling $6,300. As to Mid-America Sound Corporation, we have issued 3 violations of the General Duty Clause based upon an industry-accepted standard published by the American National Standards Institute, or ANSI, for outdoor entertainment events using temporary structures. These 3 violations are classified as knowing and are the most serious classification that we can use. Each carries a penalty of $21,000 for a total of $63,000. As to IOTSI Local 30 and Theatrical Payroll Services, Inc., we have cited them with 3 serious and 1 non-serious violation. The serious violations include the same General Duty Clause violations based upon the ANSI standard that we cited against Mid-America, 2 for fall protection and training, and the last non-serious violation was a result of not maintaining required OSHA records. The penalties imposed against IOTSI total $11,500. We did open and conduct a complete investigation with ESG Security, and we did not issue any safety orders or other warnings to ESG. We did preliminary interviews to consider opening formal investigations with at least 4 others, including James Thomas Engineering, Milby Productions, Inc., Epic Lighting, and Lucky Star, Inc., again, Sugarland. We interviewed more than 30 individuals from these and other entities, and we reviewed all of the Inspector General's interviews. We did not find reason to open any formal investigation, nor to issue any safety orders or other warnings to these other organizations. Let's circle back now around to the Indiana State Fair Commission and talk a little bit more detail about that. We essentially found that the State Fair Commission did not establish and maintain conditions of work for its employees that were reasonably safe and free from recognized hazards, in that the State Fair Commission failed to conduct a life safety evaluation as required by the National Fire Protection Association Standard 101, which required an assessment of all conditions of the Indiana State Fairgrounds, concert venues, and related appropriate safety measures. In addition, the Commission did not take measures to protect employees who were exposed to hazards, including but not limited to severe weather and hazards associated with temporary structural systems. It did not do enough with respect to planning for an adverse weather event to meet its obligations under the law, and it did not execute or implement what plan that it did have. A decision to evacuate employees as well as state fair attendees should have been made well before the time of the outflow boundary or wind gust hit the stage area. WIT Associates will have more on best practices when it releases its report, but at a minimum, these things became clear. The State Fair Commission had an inadequate plan and did not take necessary measures called for in the plan. The State Fair Commission was receiving inadequate weather information. The State Fair Commission believed that they had more time than they actually had based on weather conditions and were to make appropriate decisions. The weather front moved much more quickly than anticipated and was unusual in both speed and intensity. This is not the same as saying that even if it had developed the proper protocol, that no one would have been injured. But clearly, an earlier evacuation based upon timely National Weather Service information, as well as visual sightings of lightning in the sky before the collapse, would have changed things. Even so, there may still have been stagehands or band personnel on or near the stage. There may have been other state fair personnel in the same proximity. So again, this is not a finding that no one would have been injured. It is simply a finding that this employer did not have an adequate emergency response plan that was compliant with applicable standards imposed by law under the Indiana Occupational Safety and Health Act. The abatement that we proposed was to develop procedures to effectively conduct a life safety evaluation in accordance with the National Fire Protection Association, and to design and train on such a plan so that appropriate decisions can be made. As to Mid-America, we have handed out to you the safety order so that you can read and understand each of the 11 different instances that we cited, which we grouped into three knowing violations. Those violations encompass a range of issues, including failures to develop and implement an operations management plan, prepare proper layout drawings and engineering documentation, develop a risk assessment plan and advise workers of the hazards, conduct periodic inspections by a qualified person with appropriate documentation, keep records for each structural component, use cross bracing for the construction as recommended by the manufacturer, consider soil conditions in making determinations for guy wire attachment and placement of anchors, designate a competent person capable of identifying existing and predictable hazards and take corrective measures to eliminate them, have appropriate engineering drawings, calculations, design notes, and test results, have adequate knowledge of the engineering documentation and take into account weights of all equipment and people and reactions from fall protection systems. These violations were referenced from an ANSI standard that establishes a minimum level of design and performance parameters for the design, manufacturing, use, and maintenance of temporary ground-supported overhead structures used to cover the stage areas and support equipment in the production of outdoor entertainment events. The abatement required of Mid-America essentially requires developing, preparing, using the documentation, training, inspections, and procedures we outlined. And while we did issue significant violations and abatement suggestions, nothing we cited should be used as a conclusion that the failure to have done something caused the roof collapse. So, for example, the failure to have used a cross brace or to have inspected the structure on August 13th or to have certain engineering calculations does not mean that but for that inaction, the roof would not have collapsed. Thornton Tomasetti, again, will have no doubt more to say on that topic. Again, that was not our investigation focus. In determining that IATSE Local 30 and Theatrical Payroll Services, Inc. was the employer of the stagehands and thus could even be cited by IOSHA, we weighed the evidence and concluded that the union was indeed the employer of those stagehands working at that venue on that night. The serious violations against IATSE Local 30 include the general duty owed to its employees by failing to comply in some respects with the ANSI standard that we cited against Mid-America. IATSE supplied the head rigger, someone who was required to make determinations on the construction and guy wire attachment points and placement of the anchors for the load-bearing roof. Various factors should have been considered, including consideration of the soil conditions for those anchors, gravel versus grass versus dirt. That person has not been demonstrated to be a designated competent person as defined by the ANSI standard, who by training, knowledge and experience is capable of identifying predictable hazards and authorized to take prompt corrective action. The second violation is failure to provide fall protection equipment and training to its employees. The third was that IATSE did not verify that the required workplace hazard assessment had been performed through a written certification, particularly with respect to personal protective equipment. Finally, the fourth violation is a non-serious violation for the failure of IATSE Local 30 to maintain accurate OSHA injury and illness records. Our investigation team consisted of two compliance officers, their supervisor, and the director of general industry for IOSHA. Overseeing all of them was Deputy Commissioner of IOSHA, Jeff Carter. And I know that there is a lot to this investigation. There's a lot to this report. I am going to ask Jeff Carter to join me, and we'll try to tag team your questions so that you'll have two of us, and hopefully between the two of us, we can answer them as thoroughly as we can. Again, our safety orders will be online, where we put our media tab on our website at 11 a.m. And we are going to start with those media representatives that are here in the room. We'll save some time for those on the phone at the end. And as I call on you, if you would simply please provide your name, your news outlet, and we'll get started.
Hi, Deanna Dewberry, Wish TV. One of the controversies has been whether or not the union was indeed an employer. They contend that they weren't an employer, simply an entity that provided employees to businesses for this kind of work. So how did you all determine that they were an employer and should be cited?
We looked at the evidence and some of the factors that we weighed to determine the employer-employee relationship included the following. The State Fair Commission did not control the manner of work. They did not supervise, discharge, or discipline the workers. They did not provide them with state employee benefits. They did not do their payroll. They did not select specific personnel for work. They did not provide full-time work for union stagehands, but rather sporadic work. The State Fair Commission did not supply the equipment, the tools, or the training for union members who were highly skilled. And instead, either Local 30 or Theatrical Payroll Services, Inc., reported the workers as their employees for unemployment insurance purposes to the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. They were listed as the employer on the first reports of injury that were filed with the Workers' Compensation Board after the stage collapse. Their insurance carrier was listed on those reports. They honored child support, wage garnishments. They completed employment verification forms for those stagehands, acknowledging Local 30 or Theatrical Payroll Services as the employer. They filed W-2s with the Indiana Department of Revenue. They completed I-9 forms with the union or Theatrical Payroll Services as the employer. The union provided the supervision, the discipline, the training, and had the authority to discharge workers. The union selected the various personnel sent to various venues. Having gone through that list, there were a few factors that weighed in favor of finding the State Fair Commission as the employer. That included the duration of the relationship. Some worked there at the State Fair for many years. Work was done exclusively on the State Fair premises. Work was part of the regular business of the fair in hosting different events. And so, and the contract, I want to add too, the contract is ambiguous. It is not clear if you read every line in term of the contract exactly what the parties intended, because that would in fact be one factor, and it's just completely ambiguous and unclear. Based upon the list of factors that I just read off, we concluded that the vast majority of the factors overwhelmingly indicated that the union or Theatrical Payroll Services was the employer and not the State Fair Commission.
Nikki Kelly, Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Has the Department of Labor ever fined a union before? Is this a first ever?
Well, I don't think so.
For the state of Indiana, no, this would be a first.
And this was an unusual dynamic. I think as I read through that, hopefully it became clear that we had a lot of evidence that we weighed in determining this, coming to this conclusion. And so normally we're working with the union and citing an employer. This was a very different dynamic. I certainly acknowledge that.
Mike Corbin, WIBC. Lori, I know you have stated that this is not about causation. What you have told us this morning seems to really be damning, particularly as far as the State Fair Commission is concerned, in terms of what contributed to this accident. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think that based upon what we found is that they had some improvements they very well could have and should have made, and that we don't want to be Monday morning quarterbacks. It's easy for all of us to say, well, they should have evacuated the venue earlier, and clearly they should have evacuated the venue earlier. I mean, we can all say that 6 months later. On the other hand, they did have some National Weather Service information. They did have an emergency response plan. It's just that it was inadequate and they weren't getting enough timely. In this situation, there should have been much more frequent check-ins with the National Weather Service so they understood exactly the nature of this storm. And at the same time, this storm was unusual. I think the National Weather Service has indicated that the storm came up very quickly. There was a storm building in front of the storm in terms of the outflow boundary that was there, and so it was an unusual situation.
And so given everything you've said, you don't consider that causation still?
I do not consider the fact that they didn't have a compliant emergency response plan causation for the roof structure coming down. Plan or no plan, the wind blew over the roof structure.
Sandra Chapman, WTHR Channel 13. You mentioned that you looked at a number of the interviews that were done. It's our understanding that Cindy Hoy gave a deposition in which she said that these workers were under the direction and reported to the production director of Sugar Land as well as the State Fair Commission. Two points here, or questions I should say. Why? Can you tell us a little bit about why you did not find Lucky Star in violation of anything here, as they, according to their contract, their writer, they had the last say on what happened on that stage that night? And secondly, if the State Fair executive director herself is saying that these workers were under the direction of certain people, how much did that weigh into the decision?
Thank you. That's a good question. Let's take this, try to break down that very long question in a couple of components. One, Cindy Hoy was interviewed. We took no depositions, which are statements that are made under oath. Cindy Hoy was interviewed at least twice by our staff, and then the Inspector General conducted a number of interviews as well, and she was one person that staff for the Inspector General's office interviewed. So to be clear on the deposition. With respect to her statements and who she said that they worked for, again, what I want to say is we weighed the different factors that contribute to an employer-employee relationship. This was our conclusion as to who employed them. Sugarland was not fined. I think I heard this as part of your question. Sugarland was not fined because they have a different set of duties. They were not the venue host. They did not have employees up in the roof where there are fall protection issues. They were a performer, and so they did not come under the ANSI standard in our determination. And since we determined that the stagehands actually worked for IOTC Local 30, we did not fine Sugarland or Lucky Star, the corporate name, as a result of that.
Also, can I add, on Sugarland, they have a right of refusal, if you will, to go on. They don't have the right to override the Ms. Hoy's decision. That was never the intent there, I believe, in that, in any of the documents that they would say, if Cindy had said no and they would say yes, then it wouldn't have gone on. They had a right of refusal for themselves, not a right to initiate.
I might also add on that, though, the 2010 contract gave them a right of refusal to perform. The 2011 contract that was never signed did have some handwritten indications that said there would be a mutual decision about whether there was a hazard that would impede the performance. And then the sentence about the band had the exclusive right to, and I think they marked out sole discretion and left it at discretion, but the band had the discretion to determine not to go on. So they didn't have the right to make the sole determination of we are going to go on in the face of a veto by either the executive director of the Indiana State Fair or the state police.
Can you say?
I'm going to take one other question, though. I'm going to take other questions. If we have time, we'll circle back to you.
Ms. Torres, good morning. Raphael Sanchez with WRTV 6. On the issue of Sugar Land, they're the ones who brought in the truckloads of stuff, the rigging, the lights, and they are the ones that I would imagine are the ones that it's their stage, it's their show. How is it possible that that an organization that brings in a number of semis to the state of Indiana with all their lighting, all their rigging, all their components is in no way held responsible for the very venue which they're going to light their stars. I mean, how's that possible?
Well, I'll tell you how we determined, and Jeff can follow up if there's something that I miss here. One, Sugarland had an extensive contract with the Indiana State Fair that called out in great detail, we need so many upriggers, so many downriggers, we're bringing in so many pounds, this is what we need. And Mid-America is the one who put up and erected the load-bearing roof. That's the correct terminology for what was there. The stage is a slab of concrete on the bottom, but the load-bearing roof, which was designed to hold the lights, the sound equipment, the truss spot operators, in this case, I believe the video wall was hanging from the load-bearing roof. And so, again, this isn't about were they responsible for the fall of the stage. Our investigation, again, focusing on the fact that we determined liability, if you will, I don't even want to use that term, we determined whether they had a responsibility with respect to occupational safety and health standards that they failed to meet. And our conclusion was that Lucky Star did not. That may absolutely not be the final conclusion when we're talking about liability to the public at large. But again, this is a very narrow investigation in terms of what our role in this was. And one of the other investigators may, in fact, have other conclusions regarding that.
Rafael, I think it's important to point out there's a lot of communication that occurs beforehand on these roofs. And somebody says, we're coming in, we booked this band in, and they need to support 25,000 pounds worth of various object. And then if the roof is supposedly designed, you know, if you're within your design parameters and where it goes up, an engineer is supposed to be looking at that and saying, okay, we're good to go here. So there's a lot of communication happens before that. They don't just pull up with, you know, a bunch of trailers and start unloading equipment. They do hopefully work within those parameters.
So. Can I get a clarification then? So does that mean that with these major entertainers come to town, whether it's Madonna or Sugarland, they bring in their semis, if they are not in any way held responsible, I mean, do they not have a say as to that their trusses and their lighting is put up to a specific, so that A, their entertainers are not injured or that the public is not injured? I mean, do they get a pass? Because you're not holding Sugarland responsible in this case. Or at least you're not holding their production equipment.
For the purposes of the workplace, that's correct. We're not holding them. We concluded that there was not a violation of a workplace standard there.
Let me also add that there is a contract between the State Fair Commission and Lucas Entertainment, DBA 60.
Yes.
And that entity has a contract with Milby Productions, Inc. And Milby Productions, Inc. is the entity that basically had most of the communication with the band as to what their needs were, what they were bringing, how heavy their equipment was, what they needed with respect to the load that this particular stage could support. So as Jeff said, they don't just roll into town with no prior conversation, but there were contracts that existed between Lucas Entertainment and then Lucas Entertainment and Milby Productions. Anyone that hasn't already asked a question? Yes.
Charlie Wilson with DAP. There was a report this morning that one of the union officials said that the workers on the roof had been instructed not to leave as the storm approached. Did you investigate that? Did you determine who issued those instructions?
We looked at conversation that was had between folks on the stage and folks up in the roof, the four truss spot operators. I'm going to say that in part our investigation was hampered because we didn't get to talk to all of the stage workers. And in fact, I don't think that we had any one-on-one live interviews with any of the union workers because we were refused with respect to those interviews. As to Mid-America, we did interview a number of folks with Mid-America. There is some evidence, and there are some that say that they, one, had seen lightning in the sky ahead of time, and two, that there was some attempt to try and get the truss spot operators down. The timing of this was such that I think the time frame has been fairly well established, which was that there was an announcement made at 8:45 p.m. That is when the announcement was made that we are going to be starting the show in a couple of minutes. And the stage collapsed at 8:49. And so right at that time, while some were talking about going on with the show, there were others, perhaps, that were talking about, should we right now be getting the folks down? And so I think there was some discussion that wasn't consistent among everyone on the stage. And keep in mind, there's a lot of people there and a lot of entities that were there on the stage at the time.
Yeah, it was a little difficult with the IATSE, to be perfectly honest. The lawyers for them made it very difficult for us. We had to do a number of workarounds to try and collect our evidence. So.
Just to follow up, who did you determine had authority on the stage that night to make the decision?
That's a very good question, because it depends on what you're talking about. Who had authority to make an evacuation order? I think it's clear that the executive director of the Indiana State Fair Commission, by their emergency response plan, had the authority to make an evacuation order. Who had authority with respect to the trust spot operators, for example? Again, we found that they were employed by IATSE Local 30 and that there was a head rigger. I'm not sure that the head rigger was there at that particular time. For the most part, they took their direction from a number of people. They took their direction from Epic Lighting. They had on Epic Light, at least one had on Epic Lighting fall protection. So they were running lights. So they took some of their direction with respect to production from Epic Lighting. The Sugarland had a tour manager there. So some of the direction was given by the tour manager. So I think that it's going to depend really on exactly what we're talking about.
So do you see that as part of the problem, that there wasn't one central entity who was calling the shots, and we answered to this person, and this person is also responsible for the inspection and making sure that everything is up to code? Is that part of the problem?
That may be part of the problem. Jeff, you have follow-up on
that? I think that is part of the problem. When it comes to these concerts, it was like quite a learning experience. There's an awful lot of people that seem to be in charge up there. But when it comes to an evacuation, let me be clear. The executive director, by their emergency plan, has that call. But getting these folks down out of the trusses is no easy task. I mean, they have to shimmy across a certain area and then come down a wire rope ladder. This is not something like going out the back door of this room. This is a time-consuming, complex task to get them down.
I think it took at least 5 minutes.
It was every bit of 5 minutes or more to get them all down from up there.
That's what they had established, that it would take at least 5 minutes. Obviously, no one came down like that particular night. Right. They all fell in the stage collapse.
I guess we've been talking about the union and the Fair Commission a lot. Is it fair to say that Mid-America Sound has the most serious violations of this event?
Definitely. Theirs are classified as knowing, and the others are serious or non-serious.
And can you explain why, with a maximum penalty of $70,000 each, you only settled on $21,000 for each knowing violation?
Yes, we can.
We can. Under the our operations manual that we adopt as part of our rules and guidelines, we have to observe certain federally mandated reductions in there. This is a small employer, and so small employers are automatically guaranteed a 60% reduction in the fine. I don't
small being less than 25
less than 25 employees. So I don't have the ability to go in there and go gloss over that and push it up to the top. So.
And they got a reduction for lack of any IOSHA history with us. They were entitled to and did receive a 10% deduction for no negative IOSHA history.
And in a case like this, that probably seems a little frustrating to some that are looking at this, but the guidelines are very specific, and we follow those in all cases.
Jeff, or whoever, Jeff, just so that we're clear, it sounds like the confusion about who was in charge and what actually took place ultimately goes back to the State Fair Commission. Are we correct then?
Well, I think it goes back to the State Fair Commission with respect to when should we call the show? You know, when should we delay the show? I don't think that we can refute that. That in fact it was their duty to evacuate timely. And keep in mind that I think the evidence will show that 9:15 was the time that the National Weather Service originally thought that this was going to hit. So there was a lot of focus by the folks at the State Fair Commission on this 9:15. Obviously, the storm hit, you know, more than 25 minutes earlier than that. So, you know, at what time? It would depend on what sort of information that they were getting. We don't think they got much more accurate information after about 8 o'clock, 8:09. From the National Weather Service that was communicated to those in charge of making the decision. A lot of time was lost, really, in once the 8 o'clock weather report came out. And so what was happening is the public safety director in the operations center was monitoring the weather, made a call to the National Weather Service at 7 p.m., made another call to the National Weather Service at 8 p.m., That 8 p.m. call was communicated to the executive director and other staff at about 8:10. These are estimates because no one was looking at their watch to say exactly when they were in that meeting. And then there were a number of things that happened that sort of pushed off that decision-making later. Then when they had decided, well, we're going to go on, the band needs 30 minutes, then they ran into a problem with folks backstage, and that distracted the executive director and some of the others. By the time they had then scripted out a message that they wanted the announcer to make, you know, time continues to tick by. And so when it's all said and done, nearly 30 or 40 minutes go by before the announcement actually gets made that the concert's going on. But this was from a decision that was made 20, 25 minutes earlier based upon weather information that at that point was about 40 minutes old.
And let me be clear, evacuating a venue like this is a tricky business. This is not like when you go to school and watch our kids evacuate from the school and it's an orderly event and they have, you know, paths and everything, it goes out. Evacuating a venue like this is a very tricky business. It takes far longer than most people give it credit for. So that 30 minutes was probably pushing the envelope to completely evacuate that facility. And this storm was unusual from the standpoint that what we had is thunderstorms that were building and then dying behind, and other ones forming in front of this squall line that was moving forward. And so it pushed this outflow boundary front ahead of it, this cold air rush that was moving in front of that. And it was an unusual occurrence from that. You know, thunderstorms are not unusual in Indiana in August. But certainly this event, the way it was rotating and the way that it was developing, was unusual. National Weather Service has a whole section on this, I believe, on their Indianapolis weather page that you can see all the radar images that Mr. McCarthy's folks have put up there. So,
as far as the weather report that the fair received, was it the same report that Connor Prayer received when they evacuated their folks?
I don't know what Connor Prayer received. This was a phone call between the Operations Center and the National Weather Service, according to the interviews that we conducted. I don't have any idea what Connor Prayer received.
I have a follow-up, ma'am. Have you shared this report, or was this report shared with the governor's office and or Ms. Hoy before it was released today, or is this the first time that both those entities or people are hearing about your findings?
With respect to the State Fair Commission, we did our closing conference, which is how we close out an inspection. We did our closing conference on Monday?
Monday.
2 days ago. They don't actually get the safety orders. It's a conference to discuss the violations that we have found. It doesn't speak to penalties. It doesn't speak to abatement either. So that was with the State Fair Commission on Monday. We did that with Mid-America yesterday and with IOTC this morning, or the other way around. IOTC this yesterday and Mid-America this morning. And that was simply a matter of scheduling because they all have representatives, and so we were attempting to meet their schedules. And that's just how it turned out this particular week. With respect to the governor's office, I briefed the governor a couple of weeks ago on, in general, what our findings were going to be, and then we briefed his staff about 2 weeks ago, probably, as to what the findings were going to be.
I think Russ McQuaid.
Someone in the back with us.
Russ McQuaid, Fox 59. Did the investigators also speak with the contract meteorologist out there, and did he indicate to your investigators that he told State Fair leadership this could get here as early as 8:45 p.m.?
They did interview, are you speaking of Paul Poteet?
Yes.
All right, they did interview Paul Poteet, and he did indicate that, one, he was there to measure rainfall, but did voluntarily offer some weather advice, that he suggested that it be delayed, and I don't recall any statements that it was coming as early as 8:45. Jeff?
The investigators, he did not make that statement to my investigators, no. There was some, he was there, but again, he was there because, primarily because the State Fair had a insurance type contract that said if X amount of rain falls, then the insurance pays off. He was not there as, let me be very clear, he was not there as a contract meteorologist to predict weather for that venue.
What do you say to individuals who are saying that the other entities are being made a scapegoat because the State Fair Commission hired all these people to come in? This event took place on state property. It was up to the State Fair Commission to evacuate. It was up to the State Fair Commission to decide when to alert people about this storm.
Well, I think we can say is that we cited them for their failures to do that, to eventually make a decision and to, in fact, have the right protocol in place. Again, we didn't cite them with a knowing violation because they had done some things. I mean, Mid-America was aware of the ANSI standard and did not comply with that. The Indiana State Fair Commission did, in fact, have an emergency response plan. They had a emergency action plan just for the fair. They had a little flip chart about something they could go to very quickly to say this is the announcement we'll make in terms of a severe weather. They had undertaken an extensive training through Homeland Security, a tabletop exercise shortly before the fair. So we didn't find that it rose to that level. And so we all understand the criticism that the public or those that have been otherwise affected by this might be. But we just looked at the evidence. It would have been a lot easier to come out and say, well, we fined the State Fair Commission $1 million, and everyone might have felt better. But as it was, we looked at the evidence, we applied the standards, we applied our standard matrix in terms of what the penalty should be, and that's how they all worked out.
I would also point out, Senator, that the load-bearing roof, the structure here, is not owned by the State Fair. It was owned by Mid-America Corporation. So they brought a product onto the, they brought a device onto the grounds there. That's why we felt the need to split those apart.
But should the State Fair Commission be worried? Should Cindy Hoy, quite bluntly, be worried right now?
I don't know that she is worried any more today than what she was that particular night when all of this unfolded before her, when these tragic events unfolded. I'm not going to speculate on what her reaction is to this. I don't know.
Union leaders have implied that perhaps the state's Department of Labor would attempt to deflect some of the blame from the state. Could you speak to the independence of this investigation?
Absolutely, I certainly can. This is not the first time we have investigated a sister state agency. NDOT has had several fatalities over the course of the last several years. We inspected those and we fined them where it was appropriate. We have inspected FSSA, we have inspected DNR, IDEM, Department of Administration. So we are called upon this regularly to do inspections of our sister state agencies. We also inspect other public entities. We inspected a fatality for the Monroe County Sheriff's Department, the Vigo County Parks Department in the last year, the Muncie Fire Department, where the firefighters were killed in a fire there in the last 6 months, maybe 1 year. So we are accustomed to doing investigations for other public entities and other sister state agencies, and so we wouldn't treat and we didn't treat this any different than any other case. I understand that they disagree with our findings. I think that might be today's understatement, but that is in fact where we felt the evidence led us.
Let me be very clear. There was no, when I got the call on this one, it's like it's the State Fair, and I'm like, it's one of those that you kind of dread. It's in such an institution. But I will tell you that there was no interference. I had no interference. My investigators had no interference. We were told to follow the facts, and that's what we did.
Another question in the back.
You mentioned that the State Fair Commission did have a plan, but was that plan adequate, and was that part of your abatement to improve the plan?
No, it was not adequate. Yes, that is part of our abatement to improve the plan. Shall we take some of the callers on the line? I'm not sure if we can hear them. Is there anyone on the line?
Is there anyone there?
This is Bruce Walters from Bloomberg. I'm available.
Do you have a question?
Yes. Do you see this, as a result of this investigation, making any recommendations for new IOSHA rules or to the state legislature there to perhaps create laws and rules that will clear up the chain of command for the stage and erection responsibilities?
There actually is a set of bills pending, one in the House, one in the Senate, for inspections of stage venues and whether they're called roof structures or temporary stages. And the bills may talk about temporary stages. There is one pending in the House, one in the Senate, one that appears to be moving. It would put this in Homeland Security. I think it's the Fire and Building Services Commission that would require inspections. There's a permit that would be required to be obtained. So that's pending now in our Indiana legislature. It is not our intention to lobby for or lobby against that or to, at this point, introduce other new rules or regulations. We felt like we had the tools we needed to address the circumstances.
Yeah, the consensus standard that exists out there right now is fairly clear on inspection requirements, and
it's very thorough.
Yeah, it's very thorough, actually. So that would have been helpful.
Next caller with a question. All right, I think we've taken all the questions. Last call then.
From this room, I'm on the issue of Bid America again. So do you see them as the three folks that you find, did they share the bigger responsibility?
Well, let's be clear about what we mean by responsibility. We cited them with knowing violations, which we equate to plain indifference for the standard. I don't want that to be translated necessarily to, are they the most liable? Are they the most responsible to the public, to having the stage collapse? We felt like that with respect to the responsibility to their employees, that they showed plain indifference to the standard and therefore imposed knowing violations against them. Kevin.
Kevin Rader, WTHR-TV. Some people that will be watching and reading this, following up, will see the size of these fines and think that it's really not commensurate with the law.
How do we square it? It's a very good question. They're not commensurate with the loss, and they're not intended to be commensurate with the loss. So when we impose fines to an employer, those fines go to the state's general fund. They don't go to the families. The families have to utilize other methods of recourse. And we see this in all the fatalities we have. Last year we investigated more than 30 occupational fatalities. It's never enough to be commensurate with the loss. So in this case, it was much more visible for everyone. It was more heavily covered. There were more people that were lost in the event. But to be very honest, I mean, anytime someone is killed when they're working, the amount of fines, whether it's 6,300 or it's 630,000, it's never commensurate. And so the purpose of the OSHA Act is to encourage, in a regulatory way, employers to follow the law, to provide their employees with a reasonably safe and healthy workplace.
If I can, Kevin, the fines under OSHA are designed to, that someone violated a workplace standard. And I think sometimes when people say to me, well, what's a life worth, they're really thinking more in terms of potentially in the plaintiff or a liability situation. That's not that's not our realm. Ours is simply you violated the workplace standard for safety in there, and that's what the fine addresses there. So.
Dan, Indiana Public Media, what's the largest fine that your office has ever handed down?
Ever?
British Petroleum, about 450.
We had a significant fine with BP Whiting. That was in 2006. It was, I think it was in the $300,000 or $400,000 range. Jeff and I have only been there for just under 6 years, so I'm not, and I'm sorry, I'd be happy to get back with you on that. We can research that and see if we can come up with any other fact in that regard. That's the one that comes to my mind.
That would be the largest in the last 5 years, so.
And I just want to make sure I'm clear. There was no required state mandated safety inspection, but you said an inspection standard was, could you clarify
that? I'll let you do that, but you are correct that there was no state or governmental agency that inspected it.
That's correct. Inspections are not mandated for the state, by the state in this thing. In the consensus standard, there is clearly an inspection scheme in there that requires, one, when you inspection, when you put it up, and then in between concerts as well. Because the standard envisions the fact that these different bands bring different equipment, position it differently. You know, this may be capable of holding 100,000 pounds, but an awful lot of that depends on how you position it, where it is. All sorts of factors might impact that. So there is an inspection scheme that's envisioned in there.
Did you guys know, I never got a clear answer on how much weight the load-bearing roof was supposed to be able to bear versus what was on it? Did that come up in your investigation?
Hello?
Yes, we can do that. I'm going to have to get back with you on that one because that number I don't have off the top of my head.
Carter, what's next? How long do these folks have to pay the violations? And can they appeal it or can they just refuse to pay it?
They have 15 working days from the time they are served with the document by mail, which they will receive shortly. 15 working days in which to either ask for an informal conference. At the end of that 15 working days, they will have either, it will become either a final order in which it will be fully payable and enforceable, or they have to have filed with the Board of Safety Review, which begins the adjudication process. And then it goes to through the Board of Safety Review and then on to the courts from there if it's appealed.
So this can become a Court of Appeals issue if they choose not to, they don't believe your finding is correct and that the fine is also inappropriate in their minds.
They could.
Have any of the entities indicated to you that they intend to appeal?
IOTC has indicated that they will contest the, you say appeal, but the right terminology is that they will contest the citation and it will go before the Board of Safety Review, which is an administrative adjudication. And after it is concluded, they can then appeal that to the trial court.
And the Fair Commission has already asked for an informal conference, which is the first step to hopefully, before we get into litigation, to try and find a settlement.
And is that a sign, sir, that if they go to the Board of Safety Review, that they're already sending you a signal that they don't really think that that fine is, in their mind, appropriate?
I would say it's a sign that they disagree with us, yes.
And how many people often go to the safety, I mean, in the course of a year, do most people agree or disagree with what you have to tell them? Do you?
I think that in 2010, we had 45 cases that were contested that went to the Board of Safety Review. My recollection is that last year it was slightly under that. It may have been closer to 35 cases or so. If I find that that's way off, I'll correct that with you as well. But given in 2010, I think we did 2,000 plus investigations and 45 were contested. But when they're fatalities, I mean, it's not unusual for a fatality case to have a contest. Sometimes it provides more time for the parties to come to a resolution or to work out how the case should be resolved. So sometimes it's used for that purpose because this is a very clear deadline. If you don't file the contest within the 15 business days after you receive the certified mail receipt of the safety order, you're barred from doing anything further from it. So sometimes folks will do that just to preserve their rights to have further discussion.
And do you actually collect the fines, ma'am, or is this just a nice number you put out?
We actually collect them.
So you actually collect money from people?
We actually do.
Goes to general fund. So. And I think you asked earlier about winning and lose. This is these. I have very good investigators. These cases are very well documented, and we have very good attorneys working on this. So we generally don't lose those cases.
And by state mandate, you have to complete your investigation within 6 months, right?
Correct, which was going to run next week, August 13th to February 13th.
And have you heard gotten any response from Mid-America on where they might be standing on this?
No, we did their closing conference yesterday. This morning.
And when you hear these safety reviews, are they done separately? Are they treated as separate cases?
Definitely.
Are they treated as one big lump?
No, they're separate. All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Bob, is there any wrap-up that we need to do?
That's just a reminder, an audio file of this press briefing will be available on the DOL website in about an hour, as soon as we get that and strip it and post it up. And if you want a copy of the investigation files, Department of Labor in the South Building, they're on a DVD waiting for you. All you have to do is go sign for it.